I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, and this is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Many people seeking asylum in the U.S. cross at the southern border and turn themselves into U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Their cases may be rejected by the immigration judge, or the judge might rule in his or her favor. In either circumstance, an appeal is likely. The individual who was denied asylum will need to appeal to the Board of Immigration Appeals to prove his or her case is meritorious. Or, if the judge ruled in favor of asylum, the Department of Homeland Security will appeal for removal on behalf of the government. The Appellate Immigration Project is a San Antonio-based nonprofit providing appellate assistance to refugees and asylum seekers free of charge. Tim Patton is executive director of the Appellate Immigration Project. He joins us on Fronteras to talk about the individuals who find themselves needing his help.
The best way to illustrate that might actually be to talk about one of my cases. It's actually the only case that we have that does not involve someone from Mexico or Central America, but it's a good example of how we get involved. It involves a gentleman from the South Sudan who left the South Sudan in 1991. He's been in the United States for 27 years legally. He unfortunately got in a fight with a boyfriend of an ex-girlfriend. He did not have the best public defender. Pled guilty, and Homeland Security wanted to use that to get him out of the country. So he appeared in front of an immigration judge, which is the first level of the immigration legal system. He said, "Judge, if you send me back to the South Sudan, I will be tortured and murdered by the government." The judge, trying to do the right thing, looked at all the proof about South Sudan, which I think pretty much everybody knows is a horrible place, and said, "You're right. I'm not going to send you back. You get to stay in the United States." Homeland Security appealed. They said, "Judge, you got it wrong." They're attacking the federal judge. And at that point, that's where we get brought in. I'm on a list that I receive of possible volunteer opportunities to represent people on appeal. And so I step in at that level and write a brief, research the law, analyze the facts, and write a brief that is filed before a tribunal known as the Board of Immigration Appeals. And we argue about whether the immigration judge got it correct or ruled incorrectly. Unfortunately, in this case, the Board of Immigration Appeals agreed with Homeland Security. If our man, his first name's Ring, I can't use his whole name because it's all confidential. If Ring is sent back to South Sudan, he's a dead man. He is not going to survive being sent back. So then I appeal on his behalf to the next higher appellate court, which is the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, and we recently got him a stay where he won't be sent back so long as that court is reviewing to make its decision about whether the immigration judge was correct in allowing him to stay or the Board of Immigration Appeals was incorrect in ordering him to leave. So we are the levels up from the initial decision made about simply where somebody gets to stay or where they have to go.
And so what happens with Ring? Does he get to go back home or does he have to go into detention?
Oh, Ring's been in the entire process we're talking about. Ring is in detention and he's still in detention. About once a week, he calls me from the jail. He wants to know what's going on, but mostly he calls just to talk. And I have several other clients, most of whom are in the country legally. Others went the legal route of appearing at the border and saying, "I'd like asylum." They're not in the country illegally because you get to do that. You get to go, "I'm here. I'm going to be persecuted if you send me back to Honduras or Guatemala or Salvador." They're in detention, and they call me from various detention centers across the country.
Do you find it difficult to get in contact with clients in detention centers? Because we have heard instances where lawyers have been refused contact with their clients.
I have heard that too. I haven't had that experience. I frequently can't find them. It's not so much that I'm refused access, is that I can't figure out where they are. For example, in the case I had where I recently got the stay to keep ringing the country from the Federal Court of Appeals, I couldn't find him, and I didn't want him deported. And so I had to chase down a Department of Justice attorney who happened to be cooperative. He said, yeah, I'll find ICE, and we'll make sure your guy doesn't get deported.
So why is it so difficult to track down your clients at some of these detention centers? Is it because the records are sealed?
I suspect in part it's due to there's so many of them. I believe at the current time there's something over 500,000 people waiting for the hearing before the immigration judge, the hearing, for example, that Ring got. He waited months to get that hearing. They used to release him on bond. And I have one gentleman on bond, but for the most part, they don't do that anymore. And they're overcrowded. And I think they just shift them around due to being overwhelmed.
So have you encountered a lot of success as far as these appeals go? You were telling us about Ring and how he was able to get a stay. But we're hearing more and more now with this immigration crackdown that it's going to be more difficult for appeals process to be successful, from what I'm assuming, with this crackdown.
I would assume that's true. We recently won an appeal. We had a person seeking asylum from Honduras. He lived in a small village, and MS-13 had targeted his family because they believed correctly that they're going to testify against a gang member who had murdered another family member. He was sitting at the house with his brother, and MS-13 and came and took away his brother. Police wouldn't help, so he went searching. He was 14 at the time. He went searching for his brother and eventually found his brother horribly tortured and mutilated, and MS-13 said he was next. So he came to the U.S. seeking asylum, and the judge ruled that if he were sent back to Honduras, he would be, in fact, probably more likely not tortured and killed by MS-13. And Homeland Security once again appealed. We won this one. And he was in detention the 4 years this took. And he's been released from detention. He's out somewhere in California, and he gets to stay in the United States and doesn't have to worry about being killed by MS-13.
So why is it that Homeland Security seems so adamant to send people who obviously have proof that they will be killed or tortured if they are deported back home? Why do they insist on sending them back if they know it's a death sentence?
I would assume it's a policy where they just, in the past, they perhaps had discretion. And I suspect that currently, under the current administration, they don't have that discretion. They just have to forge ahead and fight everything. I mean, that's basically the current administration's policy. I mean, they equate a coming to the United States and saying, I want asylum, with coming here illegally. And it's simply not true. Most of the cases we have, people have been here for years, if not decades. Ring's case in the South Sudan, to me, illustrates two major misconceptions about the current immigration battles. And one is that it's this person who's here illegally, who's fighting the federal courts to stay in. One, Ring, for example, has been here legally for 27 years. And two, Ring isn't fighting the federal courts. He won. It's Homeland Security who's fighting the federal judge. We're defending the federal judge. So the whole conversation has gotten skewed in a very unfortunate way.
Tim Patton is executive director of the Appellate Immigration Project, which provides pro bono assistance to refugees and asylum seekers who are appealing their cases before the Board of Immigration Appeals. Coming up on Fronteras, One of Patton's clients is a transgender woman who's seen all kinds of horrors.
They murdered her friend. They shot her, threw in her a plastic bag by the side of the road.
We continue our conversation with Tim Patton when we come back. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. We're talking with Tim Patton, Executive Director for the Appellate Immigration Project, which provides pro bono assistance to individuals appealing their asylum cases before immigration judges. He tells us the tale of a transgender woman from Mexico whose journey to asylum is a tragic one, and a warning: some subject matter discussed in the next minute may be disturbing to listeners.
In her hometown, she was kidnapped by the police, raped, beaten along with her friend. They murdered her friend. They shot her, threw in her a plastic bag by the side of the road. Naturally, she decided to flee. Hired coyotes who, on the way to the U.S., kidnapped her and held her in captivity for 17 months, forcing her into prostitution, beating her. And then they sold her to a prostitution ring in McAllen, where she was for quite a while until a nice lady named Shirley helped her escape. She then lived in McAllen for a while and was beaten by her boyfriend, called the police, and got arrested and turned over to immigration. Horrible situation, probably the worst case we have. So she goes before an immigration judge who clearly doesn't know what to do with a transgendered individual. He said, I have to, as a matter of law, treat you as male, which, of course, is completely untrue. This is a woman who had breast implants, facial surgery, and won beauty contests in Mexico. And he insisted, for all intents and purposes, she was a homosexual male, didn't believe any of her story, and ordered her out of the country. At this point, Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid stepped in, and they in turn found me. I'm appealing the denial of her asylum. Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid is trying to get her a T visa, a trafficking visa. So sometimes these cases work in tandem. So we're fighting the battle for her, Alaska, on two fronts. One with Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid trying to get her the visa, and I'm trying to get her asylum. We'll take a win either one. We don't care which one we win. And that's the connection I have with those type of extraordinary visa things. Somebody else is doing that while I'm fighting the battle on another front.
So how do immigrants end up with your assistance? Obviously, they have to be referred to you somehow. So how does that process occur?
There's a group out of Virginia, a Catholic group out of Virginia, that receives requests from immigrants and refugees for assistance from people like me. They evaluate the case, decides whether it's worthy of an appeal, because not all appeals by immigrants and refugees can you win. Some people got convicted of horrible, horrible crimes, and Homeland Security wants them out. You're simply not going to win that type of appeal. Every appeal you can't win. If we appealed everyone who got kicked out of the country, there's just not enough hours in the day. So they essentially vet these appeals, and they send out a newsletter that says, we need volunteers for these type of cases. And I try to look for Texas cases, but I try and look for cases that are good, meritorious cases, like the case involving Alaska, the transgendered woman. You just go, man, what a horrible situation.
So you're not dealing specifically with cases in San Antonio or in South Texas. You're nationwide.
Yeah. Oh, I'm nationwide. I have Texas cases, but I have clients in California, Virginia, Minnesota, Tennessee. Initially, when I decided to do this, I thought, okay, I'll do this nonprofit where I represent some Texas immigrants and refugees, and I can kind of keep it under control and kind of have a handle on what happens. Now I'm all over the country.
So how big is your staff?
One person. We have one person. We have three directors. I'm the only attorney providing legal services. None of the directors get paid. We're all working for free because we believe in the mission, and it's truly life or death. You send Ring back to South Sudan, he dies. You send Alaska back to Mexico, she dies. So we have one person working for us who currently I'm paying out of my own pocket, but she's been my office manager, secretary, paralegal, and proofreader extraordinaire for almost 30 years. She's done appellate work, and it requires a specific skill set. So that's our staff, Debbie Grant.
That's Tim Patton, Executive Director for the Appellate Immigration Project, a nonprofit based in San Antonio offering pro bono assistance to refugees and asylum seekers appealing their cases before the Board of Immigration Appeals. A footnote to this story, Tim Patton contacted me a few weeks ago following our taped conversation to give me an update on Alaska, the transgender woman from Mexico who was denied asylum. Patton says Alaska has won her appeal and has the right to present her asylum claim again. Patton is optimistic that legal representation and a different judge will result in a positive outcome for Alaska. Of the refugees who enter the U.S., many end up in Texas, and they bring along their traditions, including their love of vegetables from home. This is happening in a handful of community gardens in Dallas. Megan Zerez reports the refugees are literally growing new traditions and helping shape the city's culture through food.
It's an overcast spring morning at the East Dallas Community Garden. Voontath is preparing this weekend's harvest. Heirloom lettuce and Cambodian bunching onions. She'll take some of it home to feed her family, but most of it will end up on other tables, in homes and restaurants all over North Texas. She's one of several hundred refugee gardeners who hold plots at community gardens across Dallas.
When I live in Thailand, I do the garden too. I sell the vegetable for a living.
Tath fled the Cambodian genocide of 1975. She spent 10 years in a refugee camp in Thailand before coming to the U.S. Taz was part of an influx of refugees who came to Dallas in the early 90s. As they fled civil wars and genocides, they managed to bring a little piece of home along with them.
Most people, as they move from one country to another, have often brought little samples of seeds that are special to them.
That's Don Lambert. He directs gardeners in community development.
Somebody had a couple of pumpkin seeds in their pocket or something, and they would find a little spot of ground somewhere around an apartment building or in a vacant lot, and they'd start trying to grow stuff.
In the beginning, that created some conflict. Landlords weren't pleased to find sprawling vines taking over their flower beds. So a coalition of refugees and resettlement agents sought to fix that problem.
They managed to get a piece of land on Fitzhugh. Around 1987, 88, they built and opened a garden.
That coalition became Gardeners in Community Development, which Lambert has headed for over 25 years. Back in the garden, Tath is tending to her plot and selling produce at a small stand. As I'm talking with her, a longtime friend shows up. Catalina Lino comes to the garden every week to stock up on vegetables and herbs. And of course, to catch up with her friend Tath. They met right here, at this garden in Vickery Meadow, a neighborhood where both women have ties. Lino is a part of the large Latino community within North Texas. She's found that there's an overlap in the foods that Latinos and Southeast Asians eat, like culantro, different types of peppers, and pumpkin flowers.
Especially the, what do you call them, with the yellow flower, flor de calabaza. And those are real good fried.
The thing is, for a long time, you couldn't find those ingredients in North Texas. According to the U.S. State Department, Texas settles more refugees than any other state. And these refugees have been shaping the way that people eat across North Texas. Sandy Bussey is one of the chef owners of Bibibop, a Korean fusion restaurant with locations across Dallas.
In this day and age, I do think a lot of those heritage vegetables and things are slowly going away.
Heritage vegetables, or heirlooms, are cultivars that have been passed down from generation to generation. It's rare to find these varieties in supermarkets, so that's why Bussy turns to small growers, like Kath.
We do the Chinese long beans, and if you actually pick it off and you eat it, I mean, the snap on it and everything is just so much better. I mean, if you think about it, you're actually picking off something and it's still living, but if you go to the grocery store, it's on its dying state.
These heirloom vegetables may be local produce now, but Lambert says it's taken 30 years and a mass migration of immigrants and refugees to make this produce available for North Texans.
There was a kind of an organic process going on in which lots of people were going to the Asian garden and getting seed and planting materials, learning how to grow those things in backyards and whatnot all over Dallas, not just by the Asian community, but a lot of other people as well.
Today, it's common to find things like lemongrass, moringa, and pumpkin blossoms in markets and kitchens all over North Texas. Like the immigrants that brought them here, those ingredients are now a part of Dallas. I'm Megan Zerez.
Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.